to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I'm really, really happy to be affiliated with the Berkman Center. I mean, you know, when I got here initially and began to interact, it was so nice to see people who shared my prejudices. And, you know, it was just so wonderful and sort of doing things about openness and so on. And so anything that I can do, you know, for you folks or any of you folks, I would love to do. And just come on down and see me or when I'm up here, whatever. So I was sort of into the thought about how to present this material, and I despite the kind introduction, I know that some of you don't know who the hell I am or what the hell I do. So I study the innovation process, and part of what I've done is sort of, as Yochai says, converted things that were really being considered in the communication space also into the physical space and physical products, and sort of made this sort of phenomenon more general. And one of the things that then I try to do is a combination with colleagues of sort of documentation of the phenomenon and what exists, and also try to give some sort of frameworks that might be useful to people. So there are a couple papers. One that I'm going to talk about, maybe more than you would like, although the whole thing will be over in 30 minutes, so you're pretty safe, which is a paradigm shift paper that I did with Carlos Baldwin. And then there's a new one showing that, just being finished today, showing it's the first national survey of the amount of physical product innovation that consumers do. And I'm delighted to know, and you're delighted to know maybe, that it turns out that it totally puts the amount that is recorded and measured by firms into the shade. I mean, it's like two or three times larger than that. So always I want to mention that you know, the kinds of things I'm reporting on, a lot of other people have done too with me and on their own. And so we have a really lively community going. And every year we meet once, about 200 of us, and talk about this sort of thing. There's some intersection between Berkman, but not a big one. So just to let you know that next year it's in Vienna. Plenty of coffee houses. Okay, so we'd love to have any of you. Now, so this you may have seen. This is the traditional idea and sort of the economic argument in the first place as to why, anyway, users rather than producers would innovate. And very quickly, the idea is that always, you know, since Marshall maybe or since Schumpeter, people have said, gee, it must be so that the manufacturer dominates the innovation process. And the reason they said that was because clearly when you look at the middle of the curve, what happens is that each user satisfies his own need, those round things are users, but the manufacturer can aggregate across all of them. And so the manufacturer, therefore, can spread costs across all of them, and therefore the manufacturer presumably can do a better job. And so what we have in our society, as you all know, is a situation where basically the laws and the rules and who you subsidize and so on focuses on manufacturers and on IP and so on and protecting manufacturers in that way rather than on users. So the tricky key here, however, is that when you look at the complete curve, what you see at the very beginning is that there aren't a lot of users. Indeed, the market is small and uncertain. And therefore, it's not such a good deal for manufacturers. So you're sort of left wondering where these innovations, in fact, that we all use, come from. And the answer is they come from users. And here's an example of such a thing. And you can see the logic on both sides. So this is John Haysham Gibbon. And what John Haysham Gibbon did was come up with the first heart-lung machine. He did it because patients, kids at that time, were dying of rheumatic fever. and the valves were so damaged that you really couldn't fix them while the heart was beating. You had to replace them. You couldn't do that without a heart-lung machine. And very reasonably, on both sides, he went off to a manufacturer, or several, in fact, and said, hey, listen, we really need one of these things. You know, it's important. There's a large population. And the manufacturer said, very sensibly, so have you developed the techniques that the heart-lung machine will enable? He said, no, I need a heart-lung machine to do it. They said, well, how do we know you can develop them? He said, well, I'm a really good vascular surgeon. They said, yeah, right. Or they didn't say that. But what they did was they took away his tea and cookies that they'd offered him, you know, and said, well, when you've done it, let us know. So that guy basically spent 20 years of his life, not an engineer, developing the first heart-lung machine. And then what happened was the cycle that we see, which is that other people come and copy the successful ones. Eventually a market emerges, small firms emerge that understand that market, and eventually large firm comes and says, well, now the risk return and the size of the market information is clear enough to us so that we can afford to get in. So basically, if you look at this as sort of over time, the size of the market grows, the certainty of the market grows, and what the manufacturers then do is choose an entry point, but it's not typically the beginning. In fact, it's seldom the beginning. And so what we did over time is we actually studied, you know, as you know, to see that we weren't, because you can find an example of anything. We studied fields, we tried to determine who innovated and so on. And this work was done way back when. And so basically what we ended up with in many fields, but not all, was that the user was the innovator. So in the case of scientific instruments, the user was pretty much 80% of the time the innovator. Now, next interesting thing you find is that the manufacturers don't know this. You say, well, that's kind of weird. You know, they're living off this curve, but they don't know it. Well, why don't they know it? Well, the answer seems to be in part that we're all good at admiring what, in fact, we specialize in. And this is what a user innovation looks like, right? You hack something together so that it works for you. And then what happens, so you're taking pieces of different machines. And then what happens is you have proven it works. This was the first one that was in medicine. It was this particular thing was the first automated radioimmunoassay system, and it was done by a doctor and his staff who had to run 20,000 heart patients and didn't want to do it manually. And so they built this thing, it spread, and then eventually the manufacturer came along. Now what did the manufacturer do? This is in here. But this has an operator's manual. I don't mean to insult them, but has an operator's manual. It actually runs, you know, steadily, reliably, and things like that. And besides, it's color coordinated, right? So that's a good thing. So when you ask the manufacturer and say, so who invented this thing? They say, we did. And then you say, well, what about this? And they say, well, that's not a product. You know, it might be an idea, but it's certainly not a product. But in fact, it is. What it is a demonstration of utility and use, the design of the thing, all the operating details. And when I had dinner at Terry's house, you know, we were talking about this sort of thing, and then he came rushing, he disappeared, and then he came rushing up from the basement waving an axe. And I thought, this dinner is not going in a direction that I normally enjoy. So, but it was an ice axe, and what Terry was saying was that, oh yes, you know, I climb, I don't know if you know this about Terry, but I climb things that no sane person would do. I climb mountains, ice axe, what do you call it? Ice climbing, there you go. And I modified my ice axe, you know? And it seemed to me why. I said, did you modify your ice axe? He said, well, I was dangling off a cliff one day, and it occurred to me that there could be an improvement. So it concentrates the mind of users oftentimes. But anyway, so now, and then you said that this thing was actually commercial now, right? I mean, they make them with those leashes and so on them. And do they credit the users?
No, there's no crediting the users.
Certainly not. Why not?
I don't think it's because they're ignorant, as you suggest. Mm-hmm. I think they know. But there isn't a custom of attribution.
Okay.
Arguably, it would be hard. Arguably, it would also be logistically difficult to attach to the initial little footnote. This came from X.
Can you speak up a little bit? There's a thing about air conditioning.
Yes, Terry. You have to speak up. So what Terry was saying was difficult to attribute. And we wouldn't know how to do it. But although they could put on that leash, Terry's leash, it seems to me a reasonable thing to do it.
Yes.
They could. Yes.
Already sort of ludicrous, that idea. But
yeah.
But there is one other dimension of this example that you embarrass me about every now and then.
I love to do it.
That I would be, once again, very eager to hear you reflect upon, which is the change in the sociology of the sport or activity that occurs at the same time as there's a transition from user innovation to manufacturing.
Yeah. So let's go into that in discussion. That's what we do in class, you know, to look at that. Excellent point, Mr. Fisher. We'll bring that up later. So now, when you look at all the law students are saying, this is so cool, right? So anyway, if you think about this in other fields, you start to see it. And what you see, for instance, this is center pivot irrigation, right? The British call them crop circles, but we know that this is actually a well in the center of each of these things, and it's a rotating thing. And before that, it was not done that way. What happened was you dug a well, and then you ran pipes here and there, and you watered the field, and then you picked the whole thing up, and you watered the field again, and you kept on moving this thing around. And this was the first one that was done by a user. This was actually the first center pivot irrigation system, and it was done by a farmer. And it's the same as a scientific instrument thing. You know, you sort of get the same sense that it's that kind of taking stuff that was around. This was the irrigation pipe that was around. This is the wheels that were around, the implement wheels and so on. And it actually is kind of a sophisticated thing. The water driving through drives these pistons, which in turn turn the wheels and so on. The wires sort of keep everything synchronized so that it goes around in a circle properly. Now, this is a modern version. And I, of course, asked them. I said, well, I called them up. Because one of the things you learn about me is that I have terribly poor taste in this and no social graces whatsoever. So I called them up. And I said, well, so who invented this wonderful device, you or someone else? Which is, of course, a good way to put it. And they said, well, we did, my son. And then I said, well, did you get any inputs from users living or dead? And they said, certainly not. And when you send us our plaque, spell our names right. And then I said, well, what about this? What do you call that? They said, that is a load of crap. You should have seen the quality of their welds. Which is interesting, because again, it's not that they're bad or so, but what they're focusing on is what they are good at. And the net result of that, plus the fact that they never attribute the damn thing, and then they advertise it and say, buy our wonderful XYZ, gives everybody sort of a sense that, in fact, manufacturers are the innovators when, in fact, they're not. Okay, so now I want to talk about this new paper, this one with Carlos Baldwin. And here the idea is that we start to understand where users innovate and will drive manufacturers out, and where collaborating users will innovate. So let me explain. This is now a design cost axis, and this is a communication axis, right? And this green zone is the producer. The producer, price times quantity, he aggregates demand in here. But now what happens? If we think about, for example, the heart-lung machine and John Haysham Gibbon, what we have is he doesn't care about communication costs because he's just talking to himself, right? He's just doing it as an individual. But what he does care about is design costs, because if it gets too expensive, he simply, as an individual, cannot afford to do it. So what's happening here is we have this kind of single user innovation. Over time, it's actually moving out this way because with computerized design assistance and the rest, these costs are dropping. Okay, design costs are dropping. Now, something else interesting has happened with the internet and so on, and that is it was occurring in spaces where people were together before that, like kayaking or other kind of contests where people got together physically. But in any case, what happens is that here, as the communication cost drops, and as you are able to modularize the problem, then what happens is all of a sudden you're not stuck in this zone for user innovation. All of a sudden you can reach out across producer space, because what happens is that each user makes a module of the thing and is justifying that module by his, in turn, use value that he gets back. But because you can communicate, you can coordinate with others, and because you have modular interfaces and so on, what happens is that these users can do things like Linux now or large projects of various kinds. So if we look at this in terms of the trends in the field, we say, well, communication cost is going to continue to drop, design cost is going to continue to drop. The producer, to some extent, is losing out, okay? Or at least he's being competed with in areas that formerly were just for the producer alone. So that, from my perspective, is good news, and from yours probably too. Now, this is this study I promise you we just finished yesterday. It was exhausting. I tell you, we suffered. But in any case, I bring to you the results of this blood, sweat, and tears. Anyway, I can't see that I've convinced anybody this is... Anyway, moving right along. So what we did was we said, fine, we have studies like that one in Scientific Instruments where we have a narrow area and we see that users are important in it. But the problem here is to say, is this generally true? Okay, or is this just a narrow niche phenomenon? Everybody you talk to and you say, wow, it works for Linux. And they say, yeah, those guys are crazy. Yeah, it works for mountain biking. Those guys are crazy too. You know, these are all exceptions. But now what this was a survey, a representative survey of the UK population. It was UK because they gave us the money. And basically what we asked was, did you create a product that you use in order to make it better for you in the last 3 years? So consumer products. Or did you modify in the last 3 years a product that you use to make it better for you? And what you see here is some percentages. Now, the interesting thing is that in aggregate, when you add this stuff up, the people who do both, the people who do one or the other, what you end up with is 2.9 million UK consumers who innovate. None of this has been measured at all, because in the government statistics, they just assume that producers are the ones who do it. Now, yes, please.
So creator modifier is a separate category. It's not
duplicated. Well, yeah, what we did was we asked them first, did you create a product in the last 3 years?
Yeah, I just wanted to.
Yeah. So this is these are the ones who do both. And, oh, and you mean, was it duplicated?
Just checking your math.
Well, good idea to check my math. I don't think so, but I better look. So, yeah.
And just to be clear, I mean, if I modify my mop by putting a rubber band around the end of it.
Let me write that down. What? No.
I have no idea what that would be useful for.
Brilliant.
Because I saw my aunt do it, would I answer yes or no to that first question?
What we did was we cast a broad net. We said, did you do that? But then what we did, and that's why we spent all the UK's money, is we said, we want to do this by telephone interviewing, and now tell us what you did. So there were two screeners, first of all. Were you the first to do this, as far as you knew? Could you buy it on the market? Was the second one. Third one actually was, did you do it for your job or for home use, right? And then what we did was we screened out the descriptions that they gave of what they did. Now let me just flick ahead so you can get a feeling for what they did. Okay? So these are the kind of things where these were the descriptions, and these were the kinds of things they did. So due to the weather, I don't know what about the weather, I want my washing machine to spin only. I modified it by changing the way the timer worked to give a spin only option. I bridged one of the circuits and inserted a switch. Okay? I made a device for trimming the tops of trees. It's a fishing rod with a large metal hook on the end. This enables me to reach the top of the trees, bend them down, and cut them. I colored the two halves of a clock dial with different colors so a child can easily see which side is past the hour and which before the hour. I used it to teach my kids to tell time. These percentages over here are the percentages of the whole sample that fell into these different categories. So these are not huge innovations, but there's something very interesting about them. They're also enormously cheap. So the money investment, the mean, was 101 UK pounds per innovation. That is project materials. The time investment was 4.8 days. But the medians was like £5 in 2 days. So what you have is sort of this vast kind of like spread across the population activity. Now 90% of these people did not communicate with others when they did it. They just sort of did it. 17% of them, in some way, they knew that somebody else had adopted it. It was not clear to us whether it was the manufacturer or whether it was the or a neighbor or whatever it might be. Okay, now, that's sort of interesting because, as I say, that's not measured at all. And it amounts to this kind of activity here again. These are single-user innovators. They're really not communicating with others, but it's in the consumer space. What it tends to do is it tends to tell you that, gee, to the extent that these are complements, that is, that to the extent that the manufacturers are benefiting from them, which we sort of see in our studies of where manufacturer innovations come from, basically the efficiency of manufacturer innovation is being overstated because what they're doing is they're drawing on this undocumented substrate. Now, this is the cake with raisins model. I thought you'd want to know. And this is a cake, and it has raisins in it. I was so impressed. The web is so wonderful. Anyway, so the point is that the cake, what we did was a survey through the cake, okay? And basically, we ended up with 6.2 innovators and 90% of them innovating alone. Now, the raisins are special interest user communities. 100% of the innovators, when we do these community studies, like studies of kayaking or mountain biking or whatever it is, what we see is they 100% collaborate. And interestingly enough, their innovations interconnect and accumulate. So what we've got then is this cake, right, of singleton kinds of innovations. I fix my clock. And then cutting through that, when we hit one of these people who's participating in a cake, what we see is, yeah, I innovate, but what we don't see from that kind of a survey, what we don't see is the fact that he's in a community where, in fact, stuff is accumulating. So when we see these kind of communities, we see a lot of people, more people in them innovating. We see in the 20s, 20%, 30%. So there's probably a lot more innovation activity also going on in those communities. And basically, this is the kind of thing that happens there. So it's really a cool thing. We're studying three communities now in addition, but this one is really interesting, and it's the first. I wouldn't do this sort of thing, but you probably all do. Basically, you look like the type of people who would, you know. Yes. So what this is whitewater kayaking. Now, people who get passionate about that tend to get together in communities because, you know, and what did they do? Over 60 years, basically, these people, it was about, started in the 50s, 73% of the hardware innovations, that is the products, were developed by the users. These are the ones that ended up commercialized. 100% of the infrastructure. In other words, these people mapped all the rivers and found out where the good rapids were and so on and so forth. And 100% of the techniques. How do you paddle this thing anyway? How do you turn, what is fun to do with this thing? So basically now, look at that. That's again, that's the raisins in the cake. You see, I know you want to imprint on this fact because you haven't had dessert. So it really is this kind, we're doing two kinds of studies and we're sort of seeing two different aspects of the kind of, in this case, consumer innovation that's going on. Okay, so now, just to give you a timeline on this again, what we're seeing is that, again, these users innovate, and a fascinating thing happens, which is that, you know, they make many innovations that nobody else wants. But what happens is those things sort of drop off, and other things that people do want sort of start to spread. So there's a filtering process going on. And then, as I mentioned, what we see, we've started to do studies of firm foundings and so on. And what you see is that, you know, these guys, let's take the rodeo kayaking story. These guys here have no clue, okay? They're manufacturers of stuff. They have no clue. And to know then whether this market is appealing and going to grow and profitable potentially, the knowledge is concentrated initially amongst these users. So typically, the users are the ones who found the companies, the early companies in these fields, and then eventually the incumbents come in. Now, so there we go. That's about that thing. Now, why user collaboratives can outcompete producers in design, this is the story that, number one, there's just more of them, and number two, very interestingly, it's the argument that it's open, that anybody can use any innovation that is found. Any kayaker that ends up coming up with a better stroke or a better shaped kayak can basically adopt it from the other. Now, there have been a couple of attempts to actually patent in that field, and I'll get to you in a second.
Network effects among many yes. collaborators.
Yes.
Are you talking, is the open aspect of it more important, or is it that extent of collaboration?
Don't know yet. Got to find out. But Terry and Yokai will be pleased to know that you know, a couple of these things in that case, every once in a while somebody will patent something. And then so we asked, so then what happens? Said, well, I told people about it. And then what happens? They laughed at me. And that was the end of that. So, yeah. Now, users, we're doing some more work. This is in the industry. All these users were typically open. And it could be because, you know, the costs of patenting and so on are too high for them. The ability to hide your innovation is low and all the rest of that. But in industrial areas, too, where they can hide things in their factories, this is industrial process equipment, what we're finding there, too, is that users tend to be open. So the same. This is a study of the same firm. Now, there's 148 Dutch SMEs were asked about their process innovation and their product innovation. Sorry, this is now switching to industrial firms. What I said in a minute ago was that users tended to innovate openly, but perhaps because they're forced. Firms often are not forced because if you're making a user in a firm case is making a process machine or a process innovation, they're benefiting from that by using it. They could hide it in their factory. So we asked these firms, we said, hey firm, gotta be polite, hey firm, what do you do with product innovations? What do you do with process innovation? Oh, we protect our product innovations to the extent we can. And no, we're perfectly happy to reveal our thing. Now, this is a function of competitiveness and so on and so forth, but there seems to be something like that. Now, Christina Rosch, who introduced herself, and is working on a welfare impacts of open with Carlos and me, because there's lots of papers around. She has been looking that say things like, we really ought to study social welfare impacts. You know, that'd be really important to know. And then they go off and do something else. And so Christina sort of cut to the nut of the thing and said, you know, this is going to be a very short paper. So say what you did.
Hi, everyone. I'm Christina, visiting from Hamburg. And yeah, well, Eric mentioned our prejudices at the beginning. And so we set out to prove a couple of them. Especially that open is a good thing. And we say, what are we looking at? We are looking at open being a new option of developing things next to manufacturer innovation. And I said, well, this a short paper, if it's a new option, it has to be good. Because people can or cannot, may not take the option. It turned out it's a bit more complicated than that. And actually policy is made in reference to that, and well, we set out to show something and give proof of something that is, I think, important to all of us, which is that yes. Open is a good thing.
And so in a collaborative way, you can give us the answer anytime you want. Yes. So please let us know. But that's what Christine is working on, and I've sort of touted Berkman to her as such a wonderful gang. So anyway. Now, that's it. Let's stop and talk. That's the story, Morning Glory. Would anybody like to? You would like to say something?
Kind of pointing to the antithesis of the Coasean reason for forming organizations. And I'd be curious to know how that offsets those types of advantages, you know, the contracting advantages, transportation cost advantages. Of the ongoing relationship and formal relationships.
Yeah, see, I'm glad.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, so he's saying basically, death to coast. Isn't this wonderful?
Oh,
no, you didn't say. See, I have the microphone. What?
To what extent does that? Is it death to coast?
Right. To what extent, I qualify, ladies and gentlemen, to what extent is it the death of coast? Well, the thing is that actually, what we're talking about here is the economics of design, right?
Okay.
So economies of scale and manufacture and so on and distribution and so on are still there. And I have hopes and you have hopes that 3D printers and so on will gradually kill off a lot of that stuff. We'll see. But, you know, in other words, distribute manufacturing too.
Yeah,
all that. So, it's just the design piece at the moment. Yeah. Yeah, please.
From sort of a policy perspective, how do you go about incorporating all of this in? Because it seems like GDP is a totally inadequate measure for it.
Well, so what we're trying to do, we have applications in to Finland and to Portugal. Well, Portugal has funded us, and the U.S., that nation. And what we're trying to do is develop metrics that can be regularly implemented. Because the data collection is completely skewed, and when policymakers don't see, actually in terms they trust, that there is a lot of user innovation out there and so on, they don't see the need to change policy. This is entirely leaving aside the fact that the incumbent, you know, manufacturers and so on are not going to be delighted about you know, shifting of emphasis and so on. So we sort of have a two-step process in mind, and the policy making of Yokai and Terry and so on are ahead of me, but the step that we're doing right now is to try to get the data clear and to try to get governments to support that. And Jim says something very wise about this.
Well, actually, a point on the GDP is, as far as government statistics office and GDP calculation go, you're really talking still a small number. So if you have 3 million user innovators and they're spending £5 each, that's £15 million. It's, or even if it's £100 each, that's still a small number in GDP terms, in terms of investment. What's interesting though is the real question is, what's the significance of the value being produced?
Right. I mean, that's exactly, and then when you get into the web delivered stuff, where if people are developing it for free and receiving it for free, it clearly has some value, but how do you go about actually accounting for that?
Right. It's not easy. And in fact, one of the issues, people sort of, at the moment we say, 2.9 million people, that is so wonderful. And they say, yes, but what if they're all just wasting their time and doing stupid things? This is not an addition to efficiency. And so what we have to do is sort of see the diffusion of this stuff and so on and so forth. And to your point, the users justify half of their investment in this stuff. We asked them what their motives were. Half of their investment based on process enjoyment or learning. So you might argue that in part it's a consumption good that they are engaged in here. So, yeah. James, you wanted to say something in addition?
Yeah, in terms of the value thing, it's still the way government GDP statistics work, it's still captured when that value is in some transaction. It's just the question of where that value comes from. Does it come from a manufacturer? But there's another aspect to it, which is, so the economists studying innovations find there's a long tail that 90% of the value comes from 10% of the innovations. And that's true if you're looking at patents, if you're looking at university inventions, or a whole variety of things.
Uh-huh.
So I think you're going to get pushed on that point a little bit. So you need to start thinking about, how do you measure that upper tail?
Yeah.
How do you measure? Right. So there are going to be a small number of those user inventions which are still very valuable. And your investment numbers were suggesting there's an upper tail there because you had, you know, somebody must have, in a sample of 100, to get the average from
to 100
to 100 pounds when the median is 5 pounds.
Somebody spent a bunch of money.
Somebody spent a bunch of money, yeah.
Yeah.
So
I agree. So we have to talk about that, and you can...
I think that it makes his point stronger, because if you think about why manufacturers fail in this model, it's because users have superior scanning abilities. They're closer to the problems. They just see more problems that are waiting for solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are responding to those problems in a way that a manufacturer can't respond, because they don't care about NPV. They don't care about the stream of cash. They say, here's an interesting problem. How do I cut the treetops?
Mm-hmm.
I'll figure out a solution. And they don't think about their investment in terms of time and cost in the same calculated, rational way that the manufacturer's R&D department would go about doing that.
Yeah.
So essentially, they sort of map the territory of problems that then manufacturers can pick the 10% that is going to be the most lucrative from.
When you say manufacturers fail this model, they have, in order to fail it, they have to be aware of it. I'm not so sure that manufacturers are aware.
No, they probably aren't largely. And one of the interesting things, though, is that when you remember, we did two kinds of studies. One of the kind of studies was to take the successful commercial innovations and track back where they came from, and we trace it back to users often. But that doesn't say what fraction of user innovations are valuable, which is Jim's point. Yeah.
What's the process that innovations are transferred to?
Well, typically, manufacturers are forced. I mean, you know, rather than
proactive in that respect.
No, I got to tell you the story, because we're also doing this in services, and it's really wonderful. So, you know, I don't know if you were engaged in this ever. This is, you remember internet and hotel rooms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I don't know if you are old enough to remember when you had to sort of wire into the phone. Yeah. Remember that? Okay.
You're old enough.
We all did that, right? So here's a service opportunity. Namely, what you're doing is you're going into the hotel, you want to dial up AOL, so you have to unscrew the phone and hook it on. So we talked to the hotels and said, so what did you do about this? And they said, well, we put in tamper-proof screws. And then you said, well, and what did the hotel guests do? They brought special screwdrivers. And what did you do? We put a steel box around the connector. And what did they do? They cut the cord. And what did you do? We thought they were going to take the hotel apart. We better figure out what they wanted. So it's very much, it's not very proactive on the manufacturer's side, in part because they don't understand where their innovations come from.
I use a lot of tools, and I'm astounded at just the simple things they miss, like switches in places where you can't find them and things
Right.
There's just no process.
No. It's impressive. Yeah. So yes, please.
This seems to be the perfect background going into a bigger problem with bigger manufacturers. So the example that you gave with the hotels is just like individuals working with small staff. But if you look at a bigger problem of innovation like piracy, like media piracy online, and then you have media conglomerates that aren't really reacting to user innovation, even though it's probably one of the biggest user innovations right now in the past decade, how do you see all of what you're seeing in your study being applied to a really big mass culture phenomenon like that?
I think, Yokai, you're the big mass culture person. Right there. He is there.
He's denying it.
So how do you see it applied? So here are these users innovators. This is what he studies, right? I mean, here are user innovators, and of course the firms resist the changing of their business models. I mean, one of the amazing things about why, you know, it's going to turn out why we ever thought manufacturers innovated is beyond me, you know? When we look at the fact that, again, techniques and all this stuff is developed by users, it's going to turn out that basically what manufacturers are good at is production of stuff, and they focus on operations. And we shouldn't expect them to respond in very agile ways, I suspect. That's my view. I don't know. What do you think? Now have I excited you enough to...
Well, no. I mean, it's part of the question is who the users are in this case. Are you talking about the artists or about the fans? What aspects are you talking about? The business models for sustaining the artists versus the versus kinds of music? Not sure how new it is. Are you talking about people mixing and creating their own remixes? I mean, all of these...
I don't think it's so much remix as direct file sharing.
Well, but in what sense are you seeing file sharing as itself innovation, or are you talking about innovation in distribution technology? But massive innovation from Freenet to Napster on, in terms of actual platforms and architecture. Is that what you're talking about? But then that's not fans and the file share. There are lots of different dimensions and a lot of innovation happening there. But in terms of the potential for the story of the fact that you've got low cost, radically distributed capitalization, you've got needs that don't fit a particular appropriation model of a particular industry, you've got very low cost of communication, both of the resources and of the innovation. This is all in the center of where it's easiest to get radically distributed production by non-manufacturers, in fact, in opposition to manufacturers. So it's not, in some senses, it's a poor case rather than a...
You see how I had to goad him to get him to talk? It was hard work, but anyway, good. Yes, please.
So I'm suspicious of a statement that says something like X percent of innovation comes from user, but mostly because I'm not an innovation scholar. And I wonder, what is innovation and how do you quantify it? I mean, having a certain percentage of people self-reporting that they did something, you can say, okay, a certain percent of people say they innovated, that makes sense. But when you talk about the big policy question, what is innovation and what is your metric? And does it presume that it's like zero sum? Because lots of times when these modules come together, the whole is greater than the part. So how are you quantifying it?
Yeah, so we've got free books for you. On the web, and if you look, what you'll see is that the studies have that start out in areas, for instance, where we're saying where did these innovations come from. So we're starting now from the fact that they were commercialized, and then we say where do they come from. What we do is we ask people what were the most important innovations in X years, and these then have been reified by the fact that they're commercial. Right? And then we track back where they come from. Now, you know, in the case of these, the consumer innovations that you just talked about, what we asked them was, did they develop or modify a product? And it was their own perception of its importance. Because there, you know, what we're trying to do, all of this, you have to remember that what we all are doing here and so on is a very, I mean, there's huge amounts of data sets and so all the rest of that. This is very pioneering stuff. This thing that I told you about with respect to the UK is the first of those. So, what did we do again? What we did was we asked them what they did. We tried to find out whether it, so already it's self-report, right? And then we say to them, well, did you see anybody else who did it, right, in effect? In other words, were you copying or not? Again, it's self-report. And then we had no lower limit for triviality, okay? So what we do in each of these studies is we say exactly what we do. But it's not, in a sense, necessarily what you would like, which is some sort of sense of, well, the most important innovations or whatever you have in mind. But you as a scholar in this field, since you will doubtless become one or are one, well, not yet. what you have to do in each of these studies is you just make damn clear what you did and what you said. And over time, what happens is people start to converge on their metrics and you get something that accumulates. Because they're all experiments. Yeah.
Eric, we have a conversation in the country that the key to our national futures is innovation. And your data says that much of the innovation occurs not in the linear manufacturing space, but in fact in users. Mm-hmm. So from all of your insights and your colleagues here, collaborators, what are the things you see in your ideas about policy changes that we should have as a nation that would turn this wealth of innovation into value, into GDP in our country?
Yeah. Well, one of the real important things, I think, and this is why it overlaps so much with Berkman, I mean, when you think about it, IP puts a cost on open. In a world where we are sort of assigning, everybody has the right to own, in effect, property, then what you've got is this situation where anybody who wants to freely release something has to first invest in making sure that he's not violating somebody else's copyright or patent. And this is sort of a major cost. I mean, there's a story that I can tell you about, and so therefore the bottom line to answer your question is, you know what, we really better do something about IP. And Terry's looking, you know, Terry wrote an article on this, and Terry is looking at, I don't know what Terry's looking at. What, Terry, speak.
All right, so here are a couple of reactions to this wonderful subject. I, as you know, care a good deal about this myself also. A few things occurred to me in response to your presentation today that it hadn't occurred to me before. So here's one of them. It's a hypothesis that would be interesting to test in a particular community is whether manufacturer responsiveness to the community of users is mediated by consumer pressure. So by that I mean, so here would be a community worth testing it on. As you know, woodworkers is an area in which there's a very high rate of user innovation. One manifestation of that is online communities that exchange ideas about new tools or new adaptations of other tools. One subset of such communities is router forums. I just checked out of curiosity. So router forums.
You know what those are? Those are cutters for wood, right?
Yeah, you have to clarify in this community that's true.
Things get really messy when you screw up those two, by the way.
If you go to Wikipedia, this would be definition two, not definition one.
Right.
So router forums has 46,000 members who exchange ideas about how to create new jigs for routers. Okay, so it's a very high participation in user innovation community. It's also, now here's the hypothesis, a community in which there's very vigorous evaluation and criticism of manufacturers' products. So some kinds of tools are just too big and elaborate to build yourself. So tenon jigs, for example, sort of on the borderline here, but the best ones are made of cast iron. There are five or six on the market. There's a ferocious community evaluating new tenon jigs. So that, I would guess, would be an arena in which your generalization, the manufacturers don't pay attention to the users, would not hold. So so there's a hypothesis.
Well, now, question for you, because it's fascinating and it might be true, but do you have any evidence that they are ignoring or paying attention to these groups? You said that the groups are very active, but...
Again, hypothesis, not proof here, is the rate of change in the design of tenon jigs seems to be pretty fast.
Okay.
And I think they rise and fall in terms of commercial popularity fairly quickly in response to these forms.
So it could be.
All right, so here's another hypothesis. You asked for some reactions.
Yeah, please.
You mentioned a couple of times in your opening presentation, and the manufacturers never give credit.
Right.
So here would be a declaration against interest on this front. Just for devil's advocate purposes here, I don't think you need to do anything about patent law or copyright law in this area, because as you point out, the user innovators don't avail themselves of these protections. So we don't need to do a lot of doctrinal reform in order to clear away the impediments that intellectual property ordinarily present, because they don't use it. On the other hand, perhaps we should, if we were running the zoo here, contrive some way to give enhanced protection for attribution. So this is responsive to your argument.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an outrage that they don't give credit the original creators. Maybe it's more than an outrage. Maybe that's the point at which a policy intervention would be effective, that the willingness of people to engage in this behavior would go up significantly if they have greater confidence in that they would get credit from the manufacturers if they were made the brilliant innovation. Now, arguably, that doesn't need law. That just needs some analog to a voluntary prize model.
Uh-huh.
It's like back when business methods were getting going, business patents were getting going, and there was some hullabaloo about it, and Jeff Bezos was embarrassed because he had availed himself of one of these things, and he helped subsidize an online system in which you gave prizes to people who would break business method patents. So analogously here, if we, the Berkman Center, had yet another spin-off project that embarrassed manufacturers of irrigation systems when they failed to give credit to the users, we could cultivate extra legally an environment in which users do benefit from attribution, and that might be the most powerful incentive in this zone.
It's a wonderful idea. I mean, Berkman is great, as you can see. Berkman is cool. You want to say something about that, Wendy? Or Judy, go ahead.
I just had a question. Have you looked at dividing up some of these innovations? Because it seems some of these things, for instance, the routers and the whitewater rafts, the innovations that the people are doing are very much in line with the types of innovations the companies would want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
They just haven't quite done that. Where certainly some of the copyright issues and potentially the hotel phone, the innovations are somewhat at odds with what the companies are doing. And it seems that is a line that would lead to very, very different response, because one, the company simply has to adapt a good idea in its next product, and the other, you're asking them to sort of radically rethink their business.
Right, right. So this is something you should do research on, Judith.
I was just curious if you thought of it in that direction.
No! I put it, this is like open source software, right? Somebody says, somebody really ought to do something. Yes! You should do it.
Question innovation.
So I mean, we look at this from the point of view of an economic perspective. So one of the stories, to fill in the story of the internet thing for a moment, the internet phone deal, what was happening was when you managed to cut the wires and you were wiring up your hotel room, which you did, basically the phone, the hotel only had a few local lines. And you were tying up a local line for a long time, and they were trying to make their money from long-distance calls and so on and so forth. So they probably had an incentive to stop it. And then what happened was that basically they found a way to sell it to you, namely the Ethernet, right? And then what happened is the users are now bringing their own Wi-Fi, and so all this internet is rotting in the wall. So yes, I mean, there is this sort of, what we're trying to understand is exactly what you're talking about, which is, well, given the present investments they have, is it a lack of information? Is it bloody-mindedness? What the heck is it that's causing this? Now, A counterexample, which is fascinating, is in kayaking. There was a group of family companies or companies of kayakers. A lot of these things are started by these. And there were long kayaks. There were always long kayaks. There were sort of travel kayaks. You went somewhere and you avoided white water because, right, you did something wonderful and graceful. Touring kayaks. Okay, there you go. And some of the people who invented these radically shorter things were employees of these companies. And they were doing this stuff on their own time. And they would come to the company and they would say, you know, we really ought to do this. And the owners of the company would say, that's not a kayak. No.
That came with the advent of fiberglass technology.
Well, yeah, and then
1970.
Well, you're talking about the rotationally molded, or you're talking about the fiberglass.
You couldn't build a shorter kayak until fiberglass came on the scene about 1970.
Well, in the '50s, I think, or so. Yeah, that's when the sport actually started with stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's probably. Well, maybe fiberglass. But I don't know, but I think most of them.
Yeah,
you
and
really
then
it,
right, yeah. So anyway, that long, fascinating stories. But Wendy,
I wanted to add a counter hypothesis to part of Terry's suggestion that intellectual property reform wasn't needed, in the thought that just at the point when your collaborations, communities of user innovators are getting to the decision of now we can commercialize, intellectual property might offer the greatest barrier, because that's the point where they come to the attention of the claimant who hasn't done anything at all in the field but has a patent or has a copyright claim on a complementary piece of content and says, stop
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
a barrier to aggregation to
yeah.
abusers.
So people here are really the experts in this, and I'm not. And I'm so glad that you know, Terry wrote a paper recently on that, and you've been writing on this. And so, you know, it's cool to be engaged in this way, you know, because I don't know the answers. Yeah.
Great stuff as ever, Eric. Thank you. I'm trying to figure out what the problem is here. So you have a system where users innovate, and then if manufacturing likes it, they steal the idea, attribution or not, and then they turn to manufacturing. That seems like it works out pretty well.
Yeah.
Manufacturers do things very, very well that individual users don't. They monetize things, which forms a very important role in the society. So
what's wrong here?
Yeah.
What's wrong with this picture? Well, I mean, again, two things. One is that the playing field is not level in some ways. You know, policies, who you give research money to, you know. I mean, you could well argue, for instance, that the internet, if you remember that drawing where you said, well, design costs and communication costs drop and they enhance this kind of a thing. So maybe you could say that the internet is sort of the roads of this age, and we should sort of think, if we systematically think about how innovation really is done, the infrastructure that exists has been built around subsidizing, in effect, or supporting big firms, and not around supporting this distributed innovation process. I mean, an egregious example, which I just love because it's so egregious, is this kind of a thing where, you know, fair use among scientists who are using scientific instruments is being curtailed because, after all, the instrument manufacturer might lose some sales, which would lower their incentive to innovate, right? But that's fascinating because, in fact, the manufacturer doesn't innovate. The user does. So what you're doing is loading costs on the innovator to give money to the manufacturer who doesn't innovate in order to encourage innovation. So when you really think about sort of the detailed articulation of all these policies, there's a lot of screwy stuff in there that could be rethought. Yeah.
What evidence do you have that manufacturers don't innovate? And where do you put a company like IDEO that's sole job is to tell manufacturers what consumers want and to help them innovate?
So there is a, basically, the manufacturers do innovate in the following sense. When we look at the kinds of innovations manufacturers do, they tend to do dimension of merit innovations. In other words, the market is there, it's well understood, and they sort of clean things up in some way. So the first scientific instrument or the first skateboard is built by the user. The manufacturer comes along and puts bearings on the thing or automated controls on the scientific instrument.
Incremental.
Well, incremental, but also sort of, in a sense, not requiring sticky functional information about what the user wants. In other words, so what IDEO does, actually, when you look at it, they are a design firm.
Yeah.
And what they do is they apply ergonomics and sort of ease of use kinds of things. A perfect example is that in operating rooms, and I'm not sure if it was Continuum or IDEO, in operating rooms, surgeons have found that if they pulse there's an irrigation water jet, and if they pulse it, they manage to clean out a wound more effectively than if it's a steady flow. So then IDEO comes along, or Continuum, I'm not sure which one, says, oh, we've got a great way to pulse the flow. You know, and look at this cool handle.
But so, don't you think they discovered that because a surgical company firm was paying IDEO or Continuum to talk to surgeons?
Yeah, but the surgeons did it, right? It's not like IDEO did it. IDEO didn't look at the problem and say, you know, to clean that wound, you could pulse. They said, wow, that's what they're doing. So does that help? Or
seems not? Like a bit of a straw man distinction.
Read the book, you'll love it.
There's a value issue there, though. So you're assuming that what the manufacturer does isn't valuable. Or is,
yes.
Yeah.
I am prejudiced to the core. It's quite true.
And there's a lot of research which says this incremental...
No, the users also do the functionally novel incremental stuff.
They do some of the incremental stuff, but there's value in what they do.
I suppose so, if you press me against the wall. Yeah.
So, Eric, it's a good snapshot data, but it begs the question of whether what you found is actually a huge increase in user innovation or a tremendous decrease, or flat, we don't know.
Now, you mean over time, or?
Yes, that's the dimension we're talking about.
Okay.
So if you look, though, for example, Standard & Poor's 500, the biggest and the best of art manufacturers, right? The stats are that from the list of the 500 40 years ago, there's only 100 still on that list. That is, we have a huge history of innovations which create new manufacturing or service enterprises, and the old ones decline.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not hearing here that very many people have any actual experience within product, service, or manufacturing companies, or you kind of know how they work inside. And you did call it earlier, very shortly. They are very linear. They work on a vector. They have a whole set of assumptions that their way is right, and they have created their success instead of it's a rising tide. And the middle level is basically people who are hired because they are good administrators keeping a vector.
Mm-hmm.
And in their best set of decisions to feather their nest, they take the company down the tubes over 10 or 20 years.
Right, right.
I'm sure you can...
Right. Well, taking out large stock bonuses. So therefore, right. So therefore, what? I mean, so
well,
what
that's
was
why I asked the question to you earlier of, okay, with all of the smarts here,
mm-hmm.
what are the possible shifts in policy,
mm-hmm.
which make it that the innovation that comes out of users,
right,
that either that value just gets to be open, or it gets out. Or gets more, or something. In other words,
yeah. No, this is exactly
the area that you're interested in gets bigger, more robust,
right.
More powerful.
Right. This is exactly what Berkman has to do. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you're here. No, in other words, I'm not a policy guy, but
you're spreading light, and the light needs to be taken by others.
Yes.
Got it.
Blessings upon you, my child. So we only have a couple of minutes left, I guess. But yeah, please.
Going back to where Rob was about what's the problem, it strikes me that you've discovered something fascinating that you'd think that if people defined it as a problem, the innovators themselves, that they weren't getting credited, that value was being taken from them, that we would hear that. And so I've been pondering that, and having just read Clay Shirky's new book, Cognitive Surplus, I'm going to some of his language, which has to do with motivation. And that the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, and that people who are innovating, that fellow who did the first heart-lung machine, wanted to fix people's hearts better. He wasn't that was his motive. Mm-hmm. It made him do his work better. He felt better about himself. The extrinsic motive is to make money. Mm-hmm. So there's a gap there. Some kind of interface between extrinsic or intrinsic origination of ideas and extrinsic refinement, manufacture, and distribution. I don't know where that goes in terms of policy, because policy is almost entirely about things in the measurable economy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what you're trying, I think, to do, if I'm understanding you right, is link the intrinsic and the extrinsic so that policy could be applied across that entire spectrum, from the first motive to fix people's hearts better to the later motive to make lots of money making machines.
So actually, I'm not sure that intrinsic and extrinsic applies here, in the sense that when a user is creating something to use it, you could argue that's not an intrinsic motive. He's trying to create a product.
Yes.
And even if it's for his own use.
Right.
But, so I guess what I'm trying to do is sort of bring, along with the rest of you, bring this kind of sort of newly emerging or, you know, because I think it's always been there, this newly visible, let us say, form of innovation into the light, so that policymaking and economics can be applied to it. Now, your points are very good about, so where's the beef, where's the problem? But I would argue, you know, for instance, another example just up your alley is synthetic biology, where synthetic biology, as you know, is you make all these little modules and you assemble them into organisms. So MIT has something called BioBricks, where they are supporting this. They have to get, so they need BioBricks, right? They need these little modules. Who do they ask? They ask undergraduates around the world. Why? Because only undergraduates are not covered by the IP policies of their universities. Who do they dare distribute it to? Nobody, because they can't afford to vet these kinds of things and make sure that they're distributing something that is not covered by somebody else's patents. So, you know, in fact, when we try to create a commons, in many cases, there are lots of barriers that policy and other things offer. And so I don't think, you know, the fact that people are not complaining, it might well mean that they're sort of living with the environment as is and not really understanding how it could be. So I don't know. Yes, please.
I was up in Maine, in southern Maine, at Fernwood, which is a museum of all these manufacturing devices that were made right before the Depression, you know, span of 50 years, somebody collected them, and I was amazed at all these inventions that were invented by farmers and the patent system that they had, you know, stenciled in, and how the patent system was so different, but I was really blown away, and apparently once the Depression came in, all this was wiped out by the small farmers, but that this time of real innovation, mechanical innovation, and it was forging metal as well as hand-built, happened, and then it got nipped in the bud, you know, and it was really clearly the economic policy that kind of decimated that, to build that on.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, one final thing, there are two final things, and then we've got to stop. Yeah.
Where do you think university-driven research falls into this framework of users versus manufacturers?
It's very much technology push, you know? It's sort of like, I mean, you can argue that it adds to the infrastructure, so it's a good thing, but it certainly is not driven by user needs, and it's far away from users often, and so on and so forth.
So outside of, like, say, the scientific instruments?
Well, those are users. The scientists are using those scientific instruments themselves. But in many cases, you know, when they're working on improved understanding of metal structures or whatever, the link to need and so on is not clear. I mean, certainly it's a valuable activity. We all do it, don't we? We all get our paychecks from it. It must be a wonderful thing. You wanted to say something really quick, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, sure. I just want to respond to you, actually. You talking about, okay, so what's the problem with this? The problem as I see it is that there's this untapped potential out there in the market. Some small user out there might have come up with something that's just awesome, but because he doesn't have the biggest company, because he's not linked into the right networks, I'm not going to be able to get a chance to use that. So I think that the problem that we're facing here is that the single consumer innovator has like a really immediate common man angle, but isn't able to refine it to the point at which someone else is going to necessarily want to pay money for it, but you know it's a good idea and might not have the expertise to really maximize it. So I think that's the problem here. There are these good ideas, maybe the best ideas, aren't the ones that we're necessarily buying. We're buying items that have clear user problems that if users were engaged in the process, if users could directly market their items, we might not be facing these issues as much.
So a wonderful statement to end up on. So thank you.